Good afternoon, everyone. Here in the House, we don't usually pound on the table with our gavels, but I'm using the Senate gavel today. Welcome, everybody. We're happy to see so much interest, and we're happy to have so many members here, since, of course, the legislature's not in session, and members have other jobs and places they have to travel from, and we're delighted to see everyone here today. Thank you all for coming. Today we are here to talk about Minnesota's system of licensing healthcare professionals, and most people know that that system has been under scrutiny for some time. Included in that scrutiny are questions about how we screen applicants for licensure and how we use our license system to assure high standards of practice and public safety once a person is licensed. I want to make it clear that today we're focusing on the latter half of that equation. We're really not going to be talking about screening people for licensure, what we call the background checks that occur or don't occur when a person is first applying. So we're going to be hearing today from the Board of Nursing, first of all, and also from DHS, because DHS, the Department of Human Services, has a role in that it investigates reports of maltreatment in licensed facilities in the state. And so we're going to be hearing from our Inspector General, Jerry Kerber, on that point. So today, the focus is going to be on what happens when a complaint is made against a licensed nurse. As a legislature, both House and Senate, we need to know how well our system's working. And we especially need to know if there are actions that we can and should take to assure public safety while we recognize that many individuals can and do change and grow. So I want to make sure that we all understand here that this hearing is not meant to be any kind of finger-pointing, punitive session with the Board of Nursing, which has been under some scrutiny lately. But there are legitimate questions about how well we're doing as a state and what more we can be doing to strike the appropriate balance between allowing people who have made mistakes to be appropriately monitored and to recover and to continue to work and protecting public safety, which is so important to all of us. So with that, I will ask Senator Sharon if she would like to say something.
I think that was very well put. Chair Liebling, and I want to add my thanks to the members of the Minnesota Senate who have been able to take time to come to the hearing today. All of us during the interim have many, many responsibilities, so I know it's a sign that we have these numbers here of our interest in having this opportunity to listen to and discuss the process of taking complaints and responding to complaints about nurses. And I want to echo as well that the goal of the meeting is really to understand more clearly and to allow the Board of Nursing that has been the subject of a number of articles in the Tribune to have an opportunity to articulate and describe and give context to the subject, which has not happened adequately, I think, as we be very careful not to draw conclusions from these articles, but to allow those who are discussed and described in this article to talk to us and to give us some context and understanding to what exists, and also to give those persons an opportunity to advise us as to what suggestions or recommendations they might make to improve the process. We all share, at least I would find it very difficult to find anybody who didn't share in the goal that when someone is given the privilege of a license to work with vulnerable populations, whether it's a nurse or a social worker or a physician, that the licensing board that oversees that process wouldn't want to hold that profession to the very highest standards. And that in the process of taking a look at a complaints against a license holder, that they want to apply a fair process that allows the license holder an opportunity to review the complaints against them and also to offer a contextual explanation for as to how something could have happened that might be rise to the level of a complaint, and also to challenge the accuracy of those complaints without having an excessive scrutiny placed on them by the public. So this is a very important subject, a delicate subject. These licenses are very valuable to the people that have worked hard to earn them. But it is also the important role of the board to protect the public, to make certain that those that do have the privilege of these license rise to the level of excellence and expertise that is necessary to serve a vulnerable population. And because the articles in the Tribune have been suggesting that that's not the case, I think it's really important that we take a look at what's happening here. You know, not everything is accurate in the media or in the newspaper. As a matter of fact, I understand that there is something on a web news saying that the articles in the newspaper have forced this legislature to have this hearing. And I can assure you that that's inaccurate. The decisions to have a hearing like this come not from somebody in the exterior world forcing us, but from what I think is something that I'm grateful for, which is good questioning and investigative reporting that helps us take a look at something more deeply. So with that, I don't think we need to do introductions, do we, Senator Liebling? Do you want to do introductions of the members that are here? No. Okay, so I'm going to turn the gavel back to Senator Liebling, and we'll proceed. Chair Liebling, excuse me. What did I call you, Senator?
Yes.
I do that all the time. Chair Liebling.
Sometimes we call that a demotion.
I know. I am sorry. I didn't mean to insult you.
Well, I do have the Senate's gavel. So, yeah. So, well, thank you, Senator Sharon. Appreciate those remarks. And so we can, I think, move right ahead and ask Shirley Brecken to come to the table.
Good afternoon.
Welcome.
My name is Shirley Brecken. I'm the executive director for the Board of Nursing, and I've sat before both of these committees several times. I do welcome the opportunity to tell you about the important work of the Board of Nursing and to address certain policy issues, I think, that have been raised in recent articles in the Star Tribune. The articles, first of all, were based on public data, and which the board provides on its website, as well as several data requests that were made by the reporter. The board complies with all requirements to the public's right to the access to data, not only because of the legal obligation, but also because the board values transparency in government. Nursing regulation exists to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public and the receipt of nursing services. The Minnesota Board of Nursing, I can assure you, is committed to this obligation. To that end, the board holds nurses accountable for conduct based on legal, ethical, and professional standards. The board achieves its mandate of public protection by outlining these standards and issuing licenses to individuals who are qualified. Once a nurse is issued a license, the board's job continues by monitoring the licensee's compliance to state laws and taking action against the licenses of those nurses who violate the law and present a risk of harm to the public. Before I begin with my outline of my presentation this afternoon, I'd like to introduce Board President Deb Hogginson and also the Director for Practice and Policy, Renee Cronquist. Both of these individuals Ms. Cronquist will be addressing the complaint process, and President Hogginson is going to bring to you the perspective of the member of the Board of Nursing. What I plan to do is, first of all, provide an overview of the board. The responsibilities of board members will be presented by President Hogginson. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the statutory authority that the board functions under, and tell you about the work of the board, including the complaint process by Ms. Cronquist, and then address some of the policy issues that were raised in the most recent newspaper articles. And finally, give you just some suggestions about possible statutory changes that the board could help the board do its work better. So with that, I would introduce President Hogginson.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Deb Hogginson. I live and work in Park Rapids, Minnesota, and I'm an RN member of the Minnesota Board of Nursing, currently serving as the president of the board. I am one of 16 members on the board appointed by the governor. 8 of those 16 members are RNs, 4 are LPNs, and 4 are public members. I think our current board membership brings a broad and diverse perspective to the table. Our current membership includes both Metro and Greater Minnesota perspectives. Our current nursing members come from an array of practice settings, including education, ambulatory care, acute care, long-term care, and advanced practice nursing. Nurses on the board practice in direct patient caregiver roles, in leadership roles, in educator roles, and in advanced practice roles. The Nurse Practice Act directs our work. It outlines the responsibilities of the board, which includes licensing nurses and prosecuting those that violate the statute. The statute outlines grounds for discipline and forms of disciplinary action. The statute also provides that nurses shall be provided the opportunity to demonstrate they are competent to practice with reasonable skill and safety. Members of the board are supported in their responsibilities by board staff who have extensive knowledge and expertise and through legal counsel provided by the Attorney General's office. I'm here representing board members who I believe, who I know serve responsibly. Board members are concerned, conscientious, and care about carrying out their duties in a responsible manner. They are thoughtful and serious in their decision making. The mission of the Board of Nursing is to protect the public's health and safety through the regulation of nursing education, licensure, and practice. Members of the board are fully committed to that mission. And because members are committed to that mission, they also support and welcome this opportunity to evaluate and consider ways to improve and strengthen the work of the board. On behalf of the board members, I want to thank you for your concern for our work today and for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Ms. Brecken.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to just Ms. Hogginson has given you information about the Nurse Practice Act. That is the major statutory authority for the Board of Nursing. It, as she said, does provide for the grounds for discipline as well as provide for the forms of disciplinary action. The board is also governed by Chapter 214, which governs all of the health-related licensing boards. And in particular, in Chapter 214, there is the requirement of legal services from the Attorney General's office and investigative services by the Attorney General's office, as well as the provisions for the Health Professional Services Program and the HIBHVBHCV monitoring program.
And Ms. Brecken, maybe you could tell us what that is.
Certainly. There is a requirement in law that individuals who are infected with HIV, HBV, or HCV will have their practice monitored. It is by the Department of Health. However, there are 5 of the boards, in addition, 4 others in addition to the Board of Nursing, that the licensees or the individuals are regulated by those boards. We commonly refer to them as the blood boards because they are their practice involves the access to human fluids, their practice is monitored for compliance with infection control procedures.
Thank you. I didn't want to pull you off track, but yeah. Just want to make sure we don't use too many acronyms that people don't understand.
I'll try to remember that. Another statute that governs the board's practice and has a great effect on the board's operations is the Government Data Practices Act, which classifies data, in particular on licensees, as well as their licensure information, as well as disciplinary information. I think the good about the Government Data Practices Act is that it does provide the public with access to data that is important to them in their decision making regarding healthcare professionals. The tough part is that in many instances the boards are not able to respond to questions because of classifications when it is classified as confidential or private, and sometimes that certainly could provide a greater picture of the situation, but there is certainly the requirements that the board must comply with. Another statute that applies to the board, of course, is the Administrative Procedures Act, which does, in fact, provide the individual with due process, including timely notice of allegations. As I said, the board does get its legal services from the Attorney General's office, and there is an Assistant Attorney General that is involved in every decision regarding any action by the board. And finally, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit later, Chapter 364, which is often referred to as the Criminal Rehabilitation Act, it has an effect on how the board operates. There are nearly 116,000 licensed nurses in Minnesota, so we are the largest of the health licensing boards. Each year, the board licenses about 8,000 new nurses, those who are new graduates and have never been licensed as a nurse. And in fact, you'll probably notice a lot of purple in the room, and I understand that they are students from Northwestern University here to learn about this process. In addition to licensure of new graduates, the board also licenses individuals who have been licensed in another state, and that term, we refer to that as licensure by endorsement. In terms of complaints, the board processes approximately 2,000 jurisdictional complaints each year. The board makes decisions about these complaints considering factors such as seriousness of the complaint, frequency of the behavior, duration, and imminence of risk of harm to the public. The law does provide an array of disciplinary actions that the board may impose, ranging from reprimand to revocation. In 2013, the board imposed 399 disciplinary actions on nurse licenses. And as you know, some of those suspensions are due to non-payment of child support and or tax delinquency. I've removed those from this particular representation because we wanted to focus on practice. But even when we remove those cases from the discussion, you will note that removal from practice, that is revocation, voluntary surrender, suspension of the license, or an order of inactive status, is still the most common form of disciplinary action. In fact, about 60% of the actions that the board takes results in a nurse being removed from practice. Many of you who read the Star Tribune articles may recall a reference to an attorney named Edie Brouse, who represents nurses before the boards of nursing in New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. The article reported that she reviewed cases and concluded that Minnesota is not nearly as punitive compared to those states. Now, my assumption is that her comments were anecdotal because we extrapolated data, disciplinary data, from the National Council of State Boards of Nursing website and their disciplinary statistics as reported by Minnesota, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. And our analysis showed that in 2012, 2010, and 2009, Minnesota had a greater percentage of suspensions and revocations per RN licenses than New Jersey, New York, or Pennsylvania. And in 2011, Minnesota was second to Pennsylvania and followed by New York and New Jersey. You have in your handouts an article entitled Management of Complaints Against Nurses, Review, Investigation, Action, and Resolution. And that was written by Renee Cronquist, who is the board's director for practice and policy. Renee is a nurse attorney, and the board's and I'm proud to tell you that she was requested to write that article because of her expertise in this area. She has spoken nationally on the subject, and she's prepared to provide an overview of the complaint resolution process of the board. So I introduce to you Renee Cronquist.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And please just state your name for the record.
I will. My name is Renee Cronquist, and I am the Director for Practice and Policy at the Minnesota Board of Nursing. Madam Chairs, members of the committee, it is my honor to represent the Board of Nursing before you today. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with information about the board's complaint review process. I know you understand from your experience as legislators, the policy issues are complex and nuanced. Whether the matter is healthcare, education, the economy, or crime and justice, reasonable minds can differ on the best approach to tackling an issue and reaching an outcome that is best for the citizens of our state. As you've heard, the Board of Nursing is charged with ensuring that the public receives nursing care from individuals that are safe, ethical, and competent. An important task, no doubt. A component of any complete regulatory program is the need to address concerns with practitioners. What to do about those individuals that are alleged to have failed to meet the expectation of safe, ethical, and competent nursing practice? It might be easy to reduce the problem to a simple equation. A bad nurse should be summarily removed from practice. Problem solved. I submit that the matter is not as simple as that. Board members are fully aware that behind nearly every report to the board are human beings who have been harmed or for which there was potential for harm. The board's decisions cannot undo the harm or change what has happened. What the board can do is address the potential for future harm. The focus of the board's approach is to seek to determine what happened, why, and how to best remedy the identified problems within the parameters of the board's authority. As Ms. Brecken has identified, there are a number of laws that provide the framework for the board's complaint review process, the Practice Act, the Data Practices Act, and so on. I would also add the Americans with Disabilities Act and, of course, the constitutional provisions for due process. To begin at the beginning, the process begins with the complaint. That is to say, unlike some other boards, the board does not have inspection authority. The board is notified in some manner of a concern regarding a nurse, most often by employers of nurses. Employers of nurses, through the chief nursing officer, are mandated to report to the board when the organization takes employment actions for reasons that would be grounds for discipline by the board. Additionally, persons licensed by any Minnesota Health Regulatory Board, including other nurses, physicians, pharmacists, and so on, are required to report personal knowledge of conduct that they reasonably believe is grounds for disciplinary action by the board. There are a couple of things to bear in mind about those reporting obligations. First, pursuant to Chapter 214.33, a report to the HPSP fulfills the reporting obligation when the basis for the report is the inability to practice with reasonable skill and safety by reason of illness, use of alcohol, drugs, chemicals, or any other material, or as a result of a mental, physical, or psychological condition. In other words, a licensee may be reported to the HPSP and participate in the HPSP, Health Professional Services Program, without the awareness of the board. Second, the reporting of professional knowledge obtained in the course of a health professional client relationship is excluded from mandatory reporting when the client is a nurse and the health professional successfully counsels the nurse to limit or withdraw from practice to the extent required by the impairment. Additional sources of reports or complaints are patients and family members, applicants and licensees through self-disclosure on applications for either initial licensure, renewal, or re-registration. And then under a variety of specified circumstances, insurers, court administrators, the Minnesota Department of Revenue and Child Support Collection Agencies, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and the HPSP are required to report to the board. And finally, the board becomes aware of disciplinary actions taken by other boards of nursing through a national nurse database, NurseSys. Upon receipt, each complaint is reviewed to determine whether the complaint is jurisdictional, that is, within the authority of the board to act, the appropriate initial priority for that complaint, and what additional information and evidence is needed to substantiate or refute the allegations. In some cases, the board will request that investigators from the Office of the Attorney General conduct a field investigation. Under Chapter 214, an AGO investigation is mandatory for any complaint alleging sexual contact or conduct with a client. An AGO investigation typically includes reviewing and obtaining records and interviews with relevant parties. Most of the complaints that the board receives do require additional documentation and evidence to substantiate the board's burden of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence. There's a variety of records that the board might obtain: employment records of the nurse, either from the employing reporting employer or possibly previous employers. The board might obtain medical records of the nurse or a patient, pharmacy and prescription drug monitoring records, controlled substance inventory records, Minnesota court information, that is MNSIS, court records, police reports, and so on. Employment and medical records can usually be obtained with a board-issued subpoena. However, pursuant to federal laws related to privacy of chemical dependency records, these records require signed authorization from the licensee. Likewise, the board must obtain the nurse's permission to obtain prescription monitoring program records. Based on the nature of the allegations, the board may request or order the licensee to complete evaluations such as a chemical dependency evaluation, mental health, neuropsychological, or drug testing. The board will often obtain a written statement from the licensee, as was Senator Sharon mentioned, obtaining input from the nurse, responding to the allegations that have been sufficiently substantiated. In many cases, the board will provide the licensee with written notice of the allegations and schedule the licensee to appear before a board review panel for a disciplinary conference. The review panel conference, it's comprised of one board member and one staff member advised by an assistant attorney general. All board members participate in review panel conferences. The licensee may be represented by an attorney. One of the documents in your materials is the board's philosophy of discipline, and I'll just share some of the excerpts from that regarding outcomes. Upon considering the law and the facts, if the board determines a violation of the Nurse Practice Act has occurred, the board will take the action that best protects the public. The board utilizes a variety of actions, basing its decisions on the nature and seriousness of the violation and the evidence to substantiate the violation. The board uses minimum standards of acceptable and prevailing practice standards when evaluating the nurse's practice. The board takes into consideration corrective measures that have already been implemented and the time that has elapsed since the alleged violation. The board uses non-disciplinary approaches such as corrective action agreements or referral to the health professional services when appropriate. The board supports and enforces individual accountability and therefore holds nurses responsible for their own nursing practice. The board seeks to evaluate the behavioral choices of nurses, distinguishing between human error, at-risk behavior, and intentional reckless behavior. As was stated earlier, the array of outcomes could be a dismissal of the complaint without action, referral of the licensee to the HPSP, an agreement for corrective action, or a disciplinary action. Within disciplinary actions, you've seen the continuum from a reprimand and civil penalty, limitations and conditions on the license, suspension, and revocation. In most cases, a disciplinary action is accomplished by a stipulation and consent order to which the nurse has agreed and the board has approved with the advisement of legal counsel. If a review panel is unable to reach an acceptable resolution with a stipulation and consent order, the panel will initiate a contested case hearing. The hearing process is governed by the Administrative Procedures Act, and I'll refer you to that act for the further details. But I would just highlight that the outcome of the hearing will be findings of fact, conclusions of law, and a recommendation from the administrative law judge. The board will review those findings, conclusions, and recommendations and will issue an order, which the licensee can appeal. If the outcome of the complaint investigation is an agreement for corrective action or some type of disciplinary action, Board staff will monitor the licensee's compliance with the terms and conditions of the order. Noncompliance and violation with the order is, of course, a basis for disciplinary action and would initiate a board-generated complaint. This has been a description of the process in general terms. I would like to identify one specific type of complaint that is handled somewhat differently, and that is complaints which indicate that the licensee has admitted diverting controlled substances. Beginning in 2010, the board began to separate the behavior of diversion from what is often the underlying illness of chemical dependency. Because of the increased potential for harm with diversion, the board has modified its procedures for such complaints, including scheduling conferences immediately upon receipt of the complaint and offering proposed orders upon receipt of substantiating evidence. As you'll see soon, approximately 80% of those cases resulted in removal from practice. In closing, I would just like to thank you for the opportunity to provide this information about the board's processes and approach to complaint review, investigation, and resolution. As lengthy as these remarks have been, this represents really a summary of the process, and it doesn't fully describe the challenges that arise. I will conclude by saying that I believe any organization, agency, or department has room for improvement, and the board continually strives for accurate self-evaluation and identification or for opportunities for improvement. Having said that, I believe that the board's processes and outcomes, when viewed in their totality, reflects a commitment to ensure that the public receives nursing care from individuals that are safe, ethical, and competent.
Thank you. I think we could take a few questions from members. I have a question myself, if no one else does, but I want to give the opportunity. Okay, not seeing any. I'm going to go ahead and ask my question. Mm-hmm. Oh, Senator Sharon, did you have one?
You can go ahead. I had a few. Have they completed their...
Well, no.
No. Okay. Okay.
Ms. Brecken has more. But I just wanted to ask Ms. Cronquist while we have her. So given you obviously read the articles, and so is there anything, and I appreciate your detailed explanation. I have to say there's a lot there, and I'm sure that, you know, there's a lot there for me to get my head around. I'm sure for members who are not even as familiar, and for the public, there's a lot there. But is there anything that you found out through these articles, learned, that you think will drive a change in the process, or that is there any change that you'd like to make in your process in response to something that you learned in these articles?
Representative Liebling, with your permission, I would defer a response to that question to the very end of Ms. Brecken's presentation.
Okay.
Because we have identified some measures which we think, some changes that would be improvements to our process.
Okay,
so
thank you.
We definitely have given thought to that.
All right, thanks. And now I recall that she did say that at the beginning, and I appreciate that reminder, because, you know, I don't want anyone to get the idea here that we're here to make excuses or, you know, just to ignore what we learned, but we're just addressing it holistically. So thank you. Senator Sharon.
Yes, I would ask you to repeat, I'm sure you said this, but I was trying to absorb everything. The ear I was listening to your remarks through, as you described this process, is the data privacy issues that come into effect as you're reviewing complaints, or if there's a self-report of diversion of drugs. There were a number of times that you, so it's the reporting and the treatment of data as private. And can you talk about when it becomes public? Because part of what I was reading is concern that there is history that becomes visible to family members later that was not available to them. And so part of the question is about transparency of data. And you began to talk a little bit about what constraints you operate under. And then the second question is, you talked about this, that there is obviously a review of the data to determine its validity and the context in which something happens in order to determine an outcome. So in the time that lapses between a complaint and an action on the board, How long does that take? What happens to protect the public in the interim? So those are two questions for now.
Ms. Cronquist.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. With respect to your first question, I understood that you were asking about the Data Practices Act. Investigative data of the board is classified either as confidential when it's active investigative data or private when it's inactive. In either case, confidential or private, it is not available to the public. What is available to the public is public data and the board's actions, disciplinary actions and administrative actions, which include stipulations to cease practice and agreements for corrective action, are public. They are posted on the board's website, and when one seeks to verify the licensure status of a nurse, that would be visible. While the complaint is being reviewed, it is confidential. A piece, I think, that was underlying perhaps one of your questions was the point at which information is reported to the board. In some of the cases that were highlighted, the information was not reported to the board at the time that it occurred. So that was it, so it wasn't a matter that it was confidential or private. It was that it was not known to the board.
I'll just follow up. I was asking, once it is reported to the board, the time that it takes,
yes,
between the time that a concern is raised with the board that it has to investigate and an action, whether or not that languishes or whether or not it's efficient. Mm-hmm. And since you brought up that sometimes it's not reported to the board, I'd be interested, if not now, in terms of that issue of data not coming to the board or becoming public. Is there some action that we need to take to address that portion of the problem?
Ms. Cronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the question about the amount of time, the amount of time to resolve a complaint varies depending on its complexity and the processes that are used. So, for example, if it is a complaint that requires investigation from the Office of Attorney General, that may take additional time. If the licensee is not cooperative or exercises their right to a contested case hearing, that will add time to the process. It is important to know that the board does prioritize its complaints and assesses the severity or the risk, potential for risk of harm, and processes those most at-risk cases expeditiously. I'll refer back to the description of the cases where there's admitted diversion and the process that the board uses for that. In addition, the board does have the authority to issue temporary suspensions, which is when there is a significant risk of harm to the public, the board can essentially reverse the typical process, which under a temporary suspension is issue the suspension first and then provide the licensee with the opportunity for notice and hearing on the issues. The typical process is notice and hearing first and then action. But the board does have the opportunity to take temporary suspensions and has done so. The other... correct. In some of the situations that were highlighted in the newspaper have, in fact, been acted upon by a temporary suspension. The final thing that I would add is the board is kind of aware of the time interval and wants to be as efficient as possible. And recently, our disciplinary process, we utilized a Kaizen process to really dig down into detail in the internal steps and seek to be as efficient as in our internal processing as could be. So that certainly is a piece that we're aware of, and it is one of the benchmarks that we monitor.
Senator Sharon?
Just to conclude, do you have a sense of how often you use a temporary suspension before you move into the process of a hearing?
Ms. Cronquist.
Madam Chair, I don't have that number offhand. It is not a frequently used tool. I will say that it has been used more frequently, more recently. there is a threshold of risk that needs to be demonstrated in order to utilize that tool. And more recently, the legal advisement that we've been receiving in terms of what supports that conclusion of the necessary risk of harm has indicated that we can meet that burden of proof.
Just one more. Sure. So I don't want to dig down into this too much now because you're trying to, but I'm drawing from that if you are getting advice from the Attorney General's office, I'm assuming, or from your legal counsel, as to whether you want to do a temporary license in the front end or the back end of a process, what filter is that lawyer looking through? Is it the filter of protecting the board from concerns that they might be brought to some kind of legal action, or I'd be concerned about what is the legal advice, what is the filter that the legal advice is coming through?
Ms. Cronquist or Ms. Breck?
Madam Chair, first of all, Ms. Cronquist was addressing is that when a temporary suspension takes place, as she said, that the notice of hearing and everything, that is reversed. But there is a requirement in statute that we must be able to go to hearing within 30 days of that temporary suspension. So that means there has to be sufficient evidence available to, and legal counsel makes a decision about that, whether or not that evidence is sufficient to proceed with a temporary suspension and the subsequent hearing within that time frame. I think the other thing that, while it's not necessarily a concern about liability as much as it is, the board wants to make certain it's dotted all its I's and crossed all its T's, because if somewhere along the way the board sort of, you know, shorts the process and makes a mistake and does not follow the protocol or the requirements in law, then that's going to lengthen the time eventually, because that can be challenged. And so, of course, the board wants to be certain that it has sufficient evidence as well as has followed procedure within law to not subject it to lengthening the process if there is some error that's made.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Cronquist. So, Ms. Brecken, I think you can go ahead and move on to the next portion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this point, I'd like to address the articles that you saw recently in the Star Tribune and to point out that those articles are all based on a database of 1,007 nurses who were disciplined by the board since 2010. One of the articles focuses on 269 individuals who are listed as current and having alleged unsafe practice. I emphasize the databases of nurses who have had disciplinary action against their license. 588 of the individuals listed do not have a current license. 350 of those with alleged unsafe practice are not current, primarily due to suspension or voluntary surrender. 200 are listed as having criminal charges or convictions and are not current, again, largely because the license was suspended or revoked. The policies that are challenged in the article are whether a nurse who has been disciplined by the board should be able to remediate and re-educate to continue or return to practice, or whether a nurse who is chemically dependent and is able to demonstrate documented and sustained sobriety should be able to continue or return to nursing practice with monitoring, or the relationship between the Health Professional Services Program and the board, whether an individual who has had a criminal conviction and has met court requirements should be licensed as a nurse, and the interface between the Department of Health and the board in matters of substantiated treatment or neglect, and the relationship between the determination of disqualification from providing direct care by a licensed professional by the Department of Human Services and the Board of Nursing. And I'd like to address each one of those policies. The work of the Department of Health is to make a determination of whether a facility is culpable of maltreatment or neglect and to report that matter to the Board of Nursing in the event it involves nursing care. The work of the Board is to investigate and consider the seriousness of the event, the level of risk of harm to the public, to determine the root cause of what the nurse did or did not do in relation to a standard of care and why, and to consider the context of the event. What else was going on at the time? What resources were available to the nurse? Were there clear facility policies and adequate training in those policies? Today, achieving patient safety is viewed not only from an individual, but from a systems perspective. The approach is not to punish individuals for making mistakes, but to improve the system. That premise is the basis for the adverse health event reporting law. Certainly, this does not include reckless disregard or intent to harm. Because the board does not have authority over systems, the board works to remediate nurses within the system. Re-educating and monitoring nursing practice of those nurses who have made practice errors is consistent with human engineering knowledge and supportive of a culture of patient safety. However, when nurses have had the opportunity to remediate practice but have continued to demonstrate significant practice deficiency, the board can and does suspend the license. The majority of the disciplinary actions taken by the board involve individuals with substance use disorder as a sole or a confounding issue. The board takes a remedial approach to addressing substance use disorders consistent with the philosophy of the legislature when creating the health professional services program. Licensed health professionals...
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. Have you moved to the second point now?
I am still... Yes. Yes.
You're on point two.
An addiction and sobriety, yes.
Okay, on the first one, to remediate, the content that you're talking about there, though, is around scope of practice, competencies and scope of practice, and executing the role of the nurse. It's not necessarily neglect or drug abuse. It's a different subject you're talking about there. If somebody fails to give medication on time or gives the wrong dosage or... So in that first instance, you're talking about practice within the defined scope of practice and a failure to exercise good competencies in scientifically based practice principles, correct?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Brecken.
Senator Sharon. Yes, Senator Sharon. Very specifically talking, you know, generally about practice, scope of practice, the kinds of not meeting a specific practice standard, as you described, not giving medications on time, not documenting nursing care appropriately, maybe not performing a treatment to the standard of care, that sort of.
Thank you. I just want to emphasize that if that's the case, because if the that's where it's a remediation is an education or supports in terms of training systems for the individual, then that makes sense. There's a relationship between that and that particular kind of problem.
Yeah. And Chair?
Ms. Brecken.
Thank you.
Excuse me for interrupting you on your second
that's
point.
Okay, I'll come back to it. The board does take a remedial approach to addressing individuals with substance use disorders, and that's consistent with the philosophy of the legislature when the legislator, created the health professional services program provision in law. Licensed health professionals, not just nurses, may return to practice upon demonstrating sufficient rehabilitation and under appropriate supervision. However, in cases that involve diversion of drugs in the workplace, the board recognizes a need to parse out the illness of addiction from the violation of the standard of practice and law. In fact, the Board of Nursing proposed to the Minnesota Hospital Association the need to collectively address diversion of controlled substances. Thus, the Hospital Association and the Department of Health convened a coalition of stakeholders, including the Boards of Nursing, Pharmacy, and Medical Practice, to identify best practices and resources to prevent, identify, and investigate controlled substance diversion. The resulting roadmap to controlled substance diversion prevention has been used nationally. The board supports treatment and recovery of nurses. However, the board does take disciplinary action against nurses who divert drugs. A study in 2012 of board cases in which the initial complaint contained either an admission by the nurse or fairly substantial evidence of diversion shows the board removed the nurse from practice in 81 out of 108 cases. The board has for some time been aware that self-disclosure of criminal convictions was insufficient. Attempts to pass legislation for fingerprint-based federal criminal background checks in 2000 and 2012 were not successful. Major opposition was to the inclusion of time-limited and permanent bars to licensure, which substantially mirrored the crimes in 245C. These are the crimes for which DHS must disqualify study subjects. However, in 2013, and Senator Sharon was the chief author in the Senate, and Representative Schoen was the chief author in the House, the legislature granted to all of the health-related licensing boards authority for criminal background checks and to make determinations for licensure on a case-by-case basis. This means that applicants for licensure will be required to submit to a fingerprint-based federal FBI criminal background check prior to a determination of licensure. The legislature has adopted a policy that pursuing a meaningful profession is essential to rehabilitation and resumption of responsibilities of citizenship. And I take that wording directly from Chapter 364, commonly referred to as the Criminal Rehabilitation Act. This provides that no person shall be denied a license solely because of a prior conviction of a crime. The board is required to consider, and when I say required, the language is shall, consider any evidence of rehabilitation presented in addition to other factors such as the nature and seriousness of the crime, the length of time elapsed since the crime was committed, and others. In previous attempts at CBC legislation, the board did seek exception to this requirement, as the boards of peace officers and teaching have. The Department of Human Services makes the determination, and I know that Mr. Jerry Kerber is going to be speaking to you in just a short time, of disqualification in matters involving substantiated treatment or neglect. They have little discretion in that determination. However, they do have the authority to set aside the determination for the individual or grant a variance to the facility once the determination has been made. The legislature changed the law to give health-related licensing boards responsibility for determining what action, if any, should be taken against a licensed whom DHS makes a determination of substantiated maltreatment. This occurred in the 2000 legislative session. The effect is that DHS makes the determination that maltreatment occurred and reports it to the board, which regulates that type of health professional, not only the Board of Nursing, but the other health-related licensing boards. The board investigates the matter to identify the root cause of the event or behavior and make a determination to remove from, limit, or condition the practice of the health professional. When I spoke with both Representative Liebling and Senator Sharon earlier, they asked that the board consider and make suggestions for any types of changes that might help the board do its work better. I do believe the board does its work effectively and understands its responsibility to protect the public and takes that role very seriously. However, as Ms. Cronquist said, there's always room for improvement. The following suggestions are offered for consideration to provide the board with the additional tools to do its work. As you know, the criminal background check bill that was passed in the 2013 legislation provides for fingerprint-based checks for applicants for licensure. It also includes the requirement that the boards provide to the legislature by 2017 a plan for criminal background checks for current licensees. Ideally, that would occur with a wrap-back function. Another tool that was actually introduced into the legislature last year by Senator Nelson and did pass in the Senate was a requirement for mandatory reporting of diversion to the boards by employers. However, that bill did not pass in the House, but that certainly is a means that would help the board to do its work much more quickly and much more efficiently. Another suggestion that we have is that the
excuse me, mm-hmm. Did you want to ask a question at this point, Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a clarification. Certainly, that Senate file did require mandatory reporting by employers if there was known drug diversion. I just wanted to clarify, it did pass the Senate Health Committee and was sitting on the Senate floor from about mid-March on. It subsequently was introduced in the House at the end of March, and my colleague, Representative Liebling, I believe, was the author on that bill. I think Representative Abler might have been the chief author. And my recollection is it actually did pass the House, but it's still sitting on the Senate floor. So
I apologize.
Yes, thank you, Senator Nelson. Yes. I was going to make the same correction. And
just, just a comment. So I'm hoping this will be one of your recommendations.
It is.
Thank you. And we will do our best to get it out of the Senate this year. It will be returned, Madam Chair, to your committee, Rule 45. So when we get into session the end of February, it will be returned to your committee, and we'll work to make sure we send it back to the Senate floor for passing. So thank you for that.
Madam Chair, I apologize for the error of my statement. But I would tell you, yes, the Board of Nursing did support the legislation last year and continues in its support for that piece of legislation. Currently, individuals may self-refer or a third party may refer an individual to the Health Professional Services Program without the board's knowledge. And today, national guidelines include the requirement or at best practice that the boards be aware of who is in a monitoring program. Sometimes the board may have information the monitoring program does not, and vice versa. And the board believes the public will be better protected if the program and board are working in concert with each other. Therefore, one of the suggestions is that there be a clarification in the board's access to the Health Professional Services Program data so that regulated persons may be in the program without discipline, but not without the awareness of the board.
Ms. Brecken, let me just stop you right there and ask you a little bit about that. From what I understand about the Health Professional Services Program, and I know we're going to hear from the director of that program as well, but one of the sort of sticks that they have over somebody who's in that program is that if they fail to follow those recommendations, they will report them to the board. So if the board would simultaneously be aware when someone was in that program, wouldn't that kind of take away part of the stick of participation?
That probably, Madam Chair, leads me into my next recommendation, and maybe we can talk about those together. And that is that the board would suggest that we add discharge from the Health Professional Services Program because of noncompliance with the participation agreement as grounds for disciplinary action. Currently, what happens when an individual that's in the Health Professional Services Program, say, has dilute screens or has some missed screens or whatever, they are reported to the board, but the board has to prove that the individual has returned to use. And, with dilute screens or with missed screens, that proof is not there. The suspicion is certainly there, but not the proof. And so the board's suggestion is that discharge from the health professional services program for noncompliance with that participation agreement be grounds for disciplinary action, rather than having to go the extra step to prove that the individual has returned to use. And so I think that fits in with, you know, that is certainly a greater stick than even the having the boards aware of the individual being in the program or threatening to let the board know the individual's in the program.
Thank you.
Another area of possibility is to authorize the boards to have access to the prescription monitoring program data when an individual is under investigation by the board. Not to look at the prescribing practices of providers, but rather when individuals are under investigation by the board for possible diversion or impairment due to the use of chemicals, having access to the PMP data would give the board an additional tool, especially for individuals who are doctor shopping and looking to access to get access to more drugs. I mentioned it earlier that the Board of Teaching and the Post Board have exception from Chapter 364, and that is certainly a suggestion that the board is making. Nurses, like teachers, work with very vulnerable populations, and having the opportunity, or not the requirement to have to shall require and consider rehabilitation.
Would you articulate that again?
And sure.
I didn't quite understand the emphasis that you're making.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Breck.
Senator Sharon, currently the Post Board and the Board of Teaching have an exception to the requirements in 364. That is, they are actually able to deny a license or remove a license to an individual based on criminal conviction. What is the requirement right now in law for example, for the Board of Nursing is that the board must consider or has to consider rehabilitation of an individual. An exception, that doesn't mean that the board wouldn't do that, but it would not be mandatory to require, you know, to consider that rehabilitation.
And does consideration of rehabilitation mean that if they have engaged in rehabilitation, then it removes the condition that you need to suspend or remove the license?
Sure. Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, what is provided in the Nurse Practice Act as a grounds for disciplinary action is that is conviction of a gross misdemeanor or felony reasonably related to the practice of nursing. And so what the board is required to do in those cases, and the same consideration is in the criminal in Chapter 364, the board has to prove a nexus of the crime for which the individual is convicted to the practice of nursing. Currently, the Board of Medical Practice and the Chiropractic Board have a provision, have statutory provision regarding denial of license and revocation of a license for conviction of felony-level criminal sexual conduct offenses. And Representative Abler has been a champion of this particular provision in law. And the Board of Nursing has previously gone on record to be included in a similar provision, so that would be one that would certainly be helpful to the board in its work. Earlier, I shared with you that the Board of Nursing does not have authority over systems or over facilities, but rather over the individuals who practice within those facilities. And it is often that the board receives a report, especially from OHFC, that upon investigation, it becomes clear that it is not only the individual who has been culpable of some kind of violation of a standard or the law, but the facility or the there were system problems within the organization that caused confusion for the nurse, didn't give the nurse clear guidelines, lines of communication were insufficient. And certainly providing authority to recommend to the Department of Health and DHS that they review facility policies and procedures and practices when the board identifies systems issues that are implicated in the event would be very helpful.
Okay. Excuse me, Ms. Brecken. We have a question. Representative Schoen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brecken, I certainly can wait until they're done with this because it's going to. I need to go back.
Okay.
So,
okay. Thank you. Sorry. Go ahead.
Madam Chair. And finally, Ms. Cronquist described to you earlier that the board is required to get its field investigative services from the Attorney General's office. And there are certainly instances where it would be much more expedient and helpful that the board have the ability and the authority to conduct field investigations. And in fact, I have discussed this in the past with people at the Department of Health, especially when they are investigating a complaint of maltreatment or neglect under the Vulnerable Adult Act, that it would be helpful if the Board of Nursing could participate in that investigation, or in other words, have a collaborative or cooperative investigation, because what happens now is that the Department of Health does the investigation, substantiates the maltreatment or neglect, then reports it to the Board of Nursing, and then the Board of Nursing has to do the investigation in relationship to the nurse's culpability in the situation. And being able to view that situation together or break down the silos would certainly be very helpful. So the authority to do field investigations and at least enter into some kind of a study group to consider how we might do those investigations collaboratively could be a way for the board to better do its work.
Ms. Brecken, when you have to wait for that previous investigation to be completed before the board starts an investigation, how much time passes? How much time is lost between when a nurse perhaps commits an act of maltreatment before the board can actually begin investigating? Any ballpark idea? Ms. Cronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't speak with certainty regarding the totality of the Department of Health's investigatory process, but from what we see, I would say that there certainly are weeks to months between when an event happens, and then the department needs to complete its investigation, prepare its report, reach its conclusions, and then they refer it to us. In some instances, the facility will have simultaneously reported an event that might be maltreatment to the Department of Health, and particularly if they have terminated a nurse, they'll also have reported it to the Board of Nursing. So at times, we do know about the event at the same time the Department of Health, though there are two separate investigations going on.
Thank you. There's a question over here. Representative Wappler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Cronquist, just on this point, a follow-up, and it appeared that in at least some of the press articles that there was a much longer period of time between the incident and the actual action. And is that because these were unusually complicated, they're the exception, or, you know, can you tell us in general, the time frame you just shared seems much shorter than what at least some of the press reports have been, and can you explain that difference?
Ms. Cronquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's difficult to answer that question globally. In some instances, the event may not have been timely reported to the board. So depending on which situation we're looking at, an event may have happened, and it may not have been reported to the board in a timely manner. In other instances, say, for example, with the Department of Health report, they've concluded an investigation, and perhaps the information was timely reported to the board,
the time lags there would have been related to processing, whether that was necessity for an additional field investigation, whether it was lack of cooperation of the licensee, whether it was the need to conduct a contested case hearing. Those are the types of things that add additional time to our process.
Okay. And just a summary comment, Madam Chair, thank you, would be as we continue to wrestle with this before session, it would be really useful to get some analysis of really kind of how those cases fall. That would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Did you have something more, Ms. Brecken, on this sheet that we're on?
Madam Chair, I think one of the things that, maybe to follow up on what Ms. Cronquist said about, you know, the report may have been timely, but it may have been a complexity of the case. It may have been the additional information that was needed. I have to share with you that it's not unusual for us to issue a subpoena for records and have to follow that up with a second notice. You know, facilities are busy and they don't have a lot of, you know, sometimes extra help to do a lot of that sort of thing too. So sometimes that can add to it. We notice the individual. Sometimes they don't respond in a timely way. We schedule them maybe for a conference, and at the time the conference is to be held, the licensee notices us that he or she has retained legal counsel, and legal counsel can't come on that day because they're in court, or, you know, some other something that was scheduled, so it gets scheduled out again. So sometimes it's the processing that and the opportunity for due process for the individual that can add to the length of time that it takes to there's just such a variety of reasons that it can do that. But we certainly can provide information to you about types of cases and length of time from the issuance of the complaint to the resolution of the complaint.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Brecken. We're going to go to Representative Schoen had a question, and then we're going to go to Representative Abler, and then I think if there aren't other questions, we'll move on to Mr. Kerber. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brecken, how many other health-related boards can have an exception to Chapter 364 right now? So I guess my question is aimed at, you know, these articles were pretty hard on nurses specifically. What about the doctors? What about other health professionals? Where do they lay into some of these requests that you're coming up with? And not that they're any better or worse. Or I'd also would be curious as to how many people you think you're going to eliminate from licensing if you did get an exception to Chapter 364, and provide me an example of maybe what you see as a crime that's specifically a nexus, or how far and how broad that is. Because, I mean, I understand the law enforcement requirements or the exceptions there.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, the boards of medical practice and chiropractic have exception to 364 in cases of sexual misconduct. There are no other of the health-related licensing boards that have exception to all of Chapter 364. And could I ask you to repeat your second question, please?
I might have forgotten. Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Ms. Brecken, I might have forgotten it, too. I think the next question was actually related to, so if you're looking at your numbers now, if you had a guesstimation, how many people do you think that this would affect? So, I mean, I know this past year we're working on trying to catch them before they even walk in the door and say, you know what, this probably isn't going to be the career for you, since we know it ahead of time. But how many people do you think you might catch or be able to deal with by having this exception?
Ms. Brecken.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, I couldn't speculate on a number, but I would share with you that there was one of the cases cited in one of the news articles would have fit the category of the sexual misconduct, the exception to, you know, to 364 in relationship to sexual misconduct.
Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair, and to the two chairs. This is a really good hearing, and I appreciate the attention to all this. And I just want to, I think I'll speak once today, and just I'll offer a couple comments, then I'll be quiet. But I've worked with the boards a lot in my time, and just to get the whole context, the board spent a great deal of time doing their job one, which is to protect the public. And it's a really hard job to do, and they're not perfect at it, but that's their, if you ask any of them what their task is, what they're charged with, that's the number one task. And, you know, the nursing board is here today, and there's some circumstances that don't make us very happy. But I want to, as I was just doing the math, less than a fraction of a percent of the nurses are in this diversion program, and 99% of nurses are not even being discussed today. So it's a great profession. The hospitals are safe. Continue on as ever you have. And this kind of scrutiny that comes up from time to time helps all the boards do better jobs and better work. And I also want to remind the members of the committee that the infractions that they decide are good or bad, we decide. There was a time a decade ago or so that there was a woman who did something, and we decided that was a too small of a something to lose her license over, and we changed the law to eliminate that to create a level bar. There may be, we may decide as a committee, as a legislature, that we want to add some intensity and some new criteria about what we think is inappropriate. But that's a legislative task and totally appropriate for us here. And just a reminder of the big picture. Just a couple comments about some of the recommendations, just to caution you. Part of the beauty of the diversion program, the HBSP program, is that people actually go there without having to get embarrassed. And so if 10% is the number of the general public that has a substance abuse problem, if 10% of the professionals have a problem, most of them don't go. But you don't want to dry up that well of people who are willing to go and get treatment by making that reporting mandatory and by making it public on the behalf of the employer. So just we can do that if we want, but just proceed with caution about that. I think discharge from that program is absolutely a good reason to go to the board, and we want to make sure the board have teeth because that's been their safe harbor for the person who's got a substance problem. And some people get better, some don't, and we don't want those people putting our public at harm. And I think that you've queued up pretty well the idea about sexual offense convictions. That was almost passed. We were so close to getting it passed 1 year. And I think most all the boards were in agreement with the model that we came up for the chiropractic board, which is a very severe penalty, and then later you can rebut it. And finally, as the end session comes upon us, Madam Chair, the second group of suggestions about improving the silos and streamlining and helping investigations to happen, I think that could be worked out pretty well and with some safety and would actually improve matters. But just remember, we are a state that believes in rehabilitation. We are a country that believes in innocent until proven guilty. And even though some of these stories sound compelling and, oh no, the accused person has rights of the whole course of all the layers of protections that we have afforded our society. And so merely being accused doesn't mean you're guilty. And sometimes the investigation happens and they didn't do anything wrong. So, Madam Chair, I really commend you for this work, and I look forward to more of it going on. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler. Okay, not seeing any other questions, I'm going to move on. And thank you, Ms. Brecken and Ms. Cronquist. And I do appreciate that a lot of these suggestions, if not all of them, are very, very helpful. And I'm sure that we will be doing more work on these when we get into session, probably before session as well. And really appreciate your work here in bringing us some things that we can do to improve the way the board operates, and I'm sure that we'll be thinking more about that as time goes on.
I appreciate that we need to move on because of our time, but I would simply ask, since these are some recommendations that are coming from the board, is it your plan to try to articulate some of this for us to take action in the next legislative session?
Ms. Brecken?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we would be happy to do that.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
And I would also like to thank the committee for listening to us today. Representative Abler said it well when he said it is hard work that the board does. I've had the privilege of working with many boards over the years that I've been the executive director, and I really do I call it a privilege because they are sincere individuals who want to do the right thing for the citizens of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you. All right, we'll ask Mr. Kerber to come on up. And we are scheduled until 2:30, so we do, and we do have another testifier. Okay. So we're going to ask Mr. Kerber to kind of give us his observations of how DHS works with the Board of Nursing and perhaps some suggestions for improvement. I'm not so sure about that, but anyway, welcome to the committee, Mr. Kerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And the Inspector General's Office is made up of three divisions. One is the Background Study Division, one is the Licensing Division, and one is the Financial Fraud and Abuse Investigation Division. And I was asked to talk today just a little bit about our maltreatment investigations and how our role intersects with the Board of Nursing in that regard. We also do a lot of work in the area of background studies, but that's not the subject of this today. So, and I'll just provide a general overview of sort of the maltreatment investigation system in the state of Minnesota. When we talk about maltreatment, we're talking about maltreatment of vulnerable adults or maltreatment of minors, and those determinations are made according to two separate laws. There's the Vulnerable Adult Act or the Maltreatment of Minors Act, and the investigations are done by a number of different agencies, all public entities, county adult protection, OHFC, the Health Department's Office of Health Facility Complaints, and the Department of Human Services all investigate vulnerable adult maltreatment, and county child protection agencies and the two state agencies investigate child maltreatment under those statutes. And so together those sort of combined, that's how we come to the determinations of maltreatment. Generally, counties are investigating these maltreatment episodes when they occur in families and also when they're not in a licensed setting. The Department of Health has a responsibility in their OHFC to investigate in health department license programs. Human Services has that responsibility in Human Services license programs, but counties sort of fill the gap. Counties are looking at families and then unlicensed services such as PCA services or anything else that's out there. When we're doing these investigations, much of what we do kind of mirrors what you heard Ms. Brecken talk about what their office does. As regulators, we're always looking at a complaint that comes in and comparing what actually occurred, and first investigating what can we determine happened, and then compare that against what the regulatory standards are. Where they might be looking at the Nurse Practices Act, we're looking at, in these cases, under the Vulnerable Adult Act and the Maltreatment of Minors Act, in those specific definitions of what is maltreatment. To get to that determination, we do many of the similar things. We review individual care plans to see what staff are supposed to be doing. We look at the training of staff to see whether they've been trained on that. Facility policies and procedures for their adequacy, not only in the clarity and consistency, but also if they're in compliance with the regulatory expectations. Training records for individuals and supervision of people as they're providing those services. And we look at all of those things, then we compare that, and then we also certainly interview any number of staff or the client or family members of the client, anybody who's going to have some information that's relevant to our investigation of maltreatment. And then at the end of the day, we make a determination. And the determination is made similarly based on a preponderance of evidence standard, which is sort of the administrative law standard. It's more likely than not. 51% of the evidence suggests that this happened. And so if we then substantiate that maltreatment occurred, then we're charged with making the next determination, which is who was really responsible for that maltreatment. And the two general categories are the facility or the employer was responsible or the individual was responsible. And we make that determination about the facility using many of the same criteria that you heard the previous speakers mention. We look at, again, the adequacy of policies and procedures and direction to employees. Were they told clearly enough what they ought to be doing in those cases? And if they were not told as clearly as they ought to, then we're more likely to say that the facility is responsible for that event and maybe issue a sanction against the facility. If, on the other hand, we can see that the facility did a pretty good job in explaining what the expectations were for an individual, and that individual still chose to do something else, well, then we're certainly going to be more likely to find that individual was responsible for maltreatment. So those findings are made by under the same law, same set of criteria, by the health department or the Department of Human Services, and sometimes by counties if they're investigating kind of a service level system. All of those findings, when they substantiate, that there has been maltreatment and an individual is responsible, then those other agencies report that to our office. They report that to our background study office. And then we are the ones that actually make the referrals to the health-related licensing boards. So when we get that information in, resulting from any of those investigations, the first thing we do then is we have to evaluate it further. If we have substantiated maltreatment, then we compare that maltreatment finding against the criteria in the background study law for a possible disqualification. And those criteria are quite clear in the law. It has to be either serious maltreatment or recurring maltreatment. And as Representative Abler had mentioned, he worked a lot on those definitions, both in the maltreatment statutes, what's going to be neglect, but then also what is recurring maltreatment and serious maltreatment for purposes of disqualification. Pause a second. I want to leave time here for my speakers. So then, if we make that evaluation about the necessity of a disqualification, if an individual is disqualified, then the person has an opportunity to request a reconsideration. They can always challenge that maltreatment finding, and they have an administrative reconsideration, and they get a hearing. Sometimes a hearing is before a hearing referee, a fair hearing in the Department of Human Services. And for other settings, it's going to be really a contested case hearing. But they always have that hearing right. If there's a disqualification that goes along with it, they can appeal that disqualification too. And they can make one of two arguments. One is that they can argue that the disqualification was not based on accurate information, which in this case is the maltreatment finding. And so then those two things get consolidated together in one appeal and they proceed on. Or they can make the argument that, you know, notwithstanding the fact that I may have done that today, I don't pose a risk of harm, and this is why. And so it's a very similar process, and you heard some mention to the Criminal Offenders Rehabilitation Act, Chapter 364. And this process is, we have an exception from that law as well, because we have a substitute process created by the legislature where there's a very careful review of those arguments from a person that they don't pose a risk of harm to people receiving cares in licensed programs. And the criteria are very similar, but they're a little bit more elaborate. But so we look at things like how many disqualifying events there were, how much time has passed, what was the harm suffered by the victim, how similar is the victim to the people receiving services where the person wants to continue working or get a different job. Has the person participated in any rehabilitation? Then we make that determination about whether the person should get a set-aside. The exception to all of this, as you heard mentioned, is that if at that point we get that information about somebody having been a substantiated perpetrator of maltreatment, before we make that evaluation about possible disqualification, we determine whether or not the person holds a license with the health-related licensing board. And if they do hold a license with the health-related licensing board, then we make the referral to them, and they make that decision. And it was the year 2000 that the legislature decided that, you know, it was really the health-related licensing boards may be in a better position to evaluate really whether or not that violation in this case was a violation of the Nurse Practices Act or whatever regard. Sometimes when we're making that referral, because, as I mentioned, we get these substantiated findings of maltreatment also from counties. So in some of these cases, the maltreatment may not have anything to do with what that person was doing at their job. And frankly, some of these are regarding people's own children. The county may have determined that they were responsible for maltreatment of their own children. And so we make those referrals as well. And so then the evaluation by the Board of Nursing, you heard reference to, is a little different, because then they're trying to make a determination about whether there's really a nexus between that maltreatment event in that family setting and the services that they provide where they want to work. And so they make essentially the same decisions or the same evaluative process as we make through the reconsideration process, but they're doing it up front and deciding whether or not to issue a licensing sanction against the individual, and we're just doing it regarding whether that person can work in that facility. So that's kind of a quick overview of this process. And I'll just stand for any questions if there are any.
Okay. Questions, members?
I have one quick question.
Right, just Sharon. A quick question. You referenced factors that you consider in the process of determining a finding. Mm-hmm. And this was referenced earlier by the Board of Nursing, and that was the time that has passed.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me why that makes a difference, how long it's been since somebody diverted drugs or sexually abused someone. Or
yeah,
Mr. Kerber.
That's a good question. You know, some of these criteria are in place because of the same criteria that apply if we find something in somebody's background study. So this is essentially the background study law that's being overlaid on this situation. When we're talking about one of these maltreatment cases, it's that time is compressed. I mean, so these things have just happened. And so it isn't like a lot of time has passed. And so that variable really relates probably more often to situations where in a background study we find that 15 years ago somebody committed some offense that may, you know, may not really represent their life today.
Like a DWI.
Yeah. And Mr. Kerber, I want to ask you sort of the same question that I asked Ms. Brecken about the time, the delay in the way we do this now to have the maltreatment investigation happening and then only after the conclusion of that to have a report to the licensing board. Do you have a sense of how long that delay is? And do you think, I don't want to ask you right now to comment on legislation that isn't before us, but just to ask you generally whether you think it's worth exploring trying to have a simultaneous investigation or having working with the licensing boards from the outset so that everybody can kind of be getting the information together.
Madam Chair, I think that's an interesting idea. There is a delay, you know, and when we look at how long it takes to complete our maltreatment investigations or the health department to complete their investigations, you know, it varies. There's a range. Some we do really fast and some take a little longer, and it kind of depends on the complexity and the seriousness of the violation, certainly, and the ongoing, you know, our assessment of the ongoing risk of harm that's present in this situation versus another one. And so, you know, there can be, I think we heard, weeks and months, and there certainly can be months that it takes. If that would speed things along, I think that's certainly something that would be interesting. It'd be very interesting to explore. The scheduling of investigations, you know, is always a challenge, but certainly working with another agency and investigating this work is, you know, as long as we're not redundant, but it sounds like there might be some of that redundancy now. So if we finish our investigation, then they start and do a whole new investigation. It might be much more efficient to be doing these side by side, and they might both be faster.
Right. Yeah. Senator.
You know, I agree that I think the question of how much time does it take to do these and what can we do to help support in whatever way we can making our actions not so narrow that a person doesn't have a chance to provide information to the boards to give context, but to not have these things languish. But the other thing that I would like to ask you is, and I should have asked this earlier, is about what I heard the Board of Nursing saying is that the only thing that they report at the end of it is the disposition, that there was a suspension or there was a removal of a license. You know, it's only the action that gets reported and communicated then to employers or on the web. And I wish I'd asked them, and I'll ask you this, is that the case for you as well? And if the other data, the specifics of what was the maltreatment or what was the diversion of drugs is not public, do you see a problem with that in terms of, I see how that protects the license holder, but the issue that's raised in many of these articles is what about the public's right to know so that they can protect themselves when they make decisions about their caregivers?
Mr. Kerber.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that's a good question, and I think there's sort of there's two ways to look at that. One is when that investigation is underway and at its conclusion, the employer in that situation certainly finds out. And so that employer, and if it's an investigation done by the health department or the Department of Human Services, as I'm sure you're aware, we issue a public summary. So we issue a summary of that investigation that's then posted on the web. The employer finds out who all the disguised individuals are in the maltreatment investigation. So we refer to the people as staff person 1 through 5 and healthcare professional 1 through 5. But the employer always finds out exactly who was it that we found to be responsible for maltreatment. And so there's not much ambiguity there. I think the one of the issues, though, is if an individual moves on to a different setting where they get a job, and how much information can that new employer know about a maltreatment investigation that was at a previous employment arrangement, or if they're parallel, you know, they're tandem, they're occurring at the same time, two different jobs. It's not so much the current job or where the event happened, but it's the others that might follow. That's the issue. And there could be more data sharing there.
I appreciate that. That's the employer you're talking about getting the data, and we don't have to go into this further now. For me, the question of balance is, while we're talking about our belief system in rehabilitation and supporting the license holder, there's also a very important question being raised in these articles about the public's right to know so that they can protect themselves. And I'm really going to press, even though I have a background with a professional license, on behalf of the public's right to know more than whether or not a professional has had an action taken against their license, so that when I choose my health care provider, do I have adequate data to make a determination about who I want caring for my vulnerable child or my vulnerable adult? So we can talk about that more as we move forward.
Right. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kerber. Not seeing other questions, we'll move on to Monica Feider. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about the Health Professional Services Program. Before I get started, I want to mention that the Health Professional Services Program is not an independent state agency. It is a program of the health licensing boards. So we serve all of the health licensing boards, not just the Board of Nursing. So I'm going to give you a little history of the program and then talk more specifically about how we interface with the boards and what specifically we do.
And Ms. Feider, we might want to point out to members that there is a handout,
mm-hmm. yep.
and very helpfully Ms. Feider provided us with a flow chart, which at least helps me to sort of understand how all this is happening. So you might wish to refer to that as she speaks. Go ahead. Sorry.
Thank you. HPSP was developed back in 1994, and at the time there was concern, primarily through the Board of Medical Practice, Nursing, and Pharmacy and their related professional associations, that health professionals with illnesses were not seeking treatment for those illnesses out of fear of being disciplined by their boards. So the legislation was enacted in 1994. Renee Cronquist did an excellent job describing the statute. I want to emphasize that HPSP does not provide treatment. What we do is monitor how health professionals manage their illnesses. Our primary focus is public safety. Our mission is to enhance public safety in healthcare, and we do that by promoting early intervention, diagnosis, treatment, and monitoring of health professionals with illnesses. I also want to emphasize that we monitor health professionals with a variety of illnesses, not just substance dependence. We work with people with psychiatric disorders and other medical conditions that could potentially impair their ability to practice. In terms of the monitoring itself, I want to talk to you about how that happens. We receive referrals from the boards, both referrals that are part of a disciplinary process and referrals that are not part of a disciplinary process. We also receive referrals from individuals themselves and from third parties. The third parties are often employers, treatment providers, sometimes colleagues, family members, or other people who are concerned about that individual. The first thing we do when someone contacts the program is describe what the program is so that they would know what they're getting into. We provide them with a legal Tennyson warning, which describes what we do with the information we gather about them. We review our statutory eligibility requirements, and then we ask the individual if they want to go forward with the monitoring process or the intake process. If they say yes, we gather a brief social, psychiatric, substance, medical, and vocational history. And it's important to recognize that people come to us at all different points in their recovery or in their illness. For example, a nurse may call because she was just sent home from work for smelling of alcohol. Someone else may call because they're in treatment and the treatment program recommended that HPSP would be a good program for them. So in our intake interview with the individual, it provides us with information about whether or not further assessments are needed, whether or not, for example, there are oftentimes we ask immediately that the licensee refrain from practice until they can get assessed. So, and it's a voluntary, we're a voluntary program for the most part, unless people are referred by their boards under an order. So people are voluntarily restricting their practice, getting a substance use evaluation, maybe it's a psychiatric evaluation, it could be a pain management assessment, a variety of different assessments based on what the individual presents with. So we gathered those records from the different assessors and developed monitoring plans. If the individual has an illness that warrants monitoring. If they don't have an illness that warrants monitoring, we would close the file. However, if there is a practice issue identified that is not illness-related, we would report that to the licensing board. For individuals who do have an illness that warrants monitoring, there are some very standard conditions of the monitoring. One is that they have to have a workplace monitor, which is usually their direct supervisor, their manager, department head, someone that they report to. And that individual provides us with reports about their professional performance. And I'll talk a little bit more about worksite monitors or in a bit related to diversion. The other thing that they have to have are treatment providers that are treating them for the illnesses that they're being monitored for. And again, depending on the illnesses that the individual has, that could be a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a pain management physician, a neurologist, variety of different providers. Once the other individualized, so those are the basic pieces of monitoring, the more individualized pieces of monitoring are directed more related to their risk to patients based on their profession and also their illness. In cases, for example, of diversion, diversion we think of as one thing, but diversion among nurses is different among diversion among pharmacists. So we have requirements for different professions that directly relate to their practice setting. For example, anyone who diverts or has diverted drugs from work, we ask them to not have access to controlled substances for a minimum of 12 months of recovery or their time in the program. After that, we ask for supervised access of controlled substances. And we rely on the workplace monitor to assure us that they are that the individual is not having access to controlled substances. The worksite monitor, again, provides us with regular reports about the individual's professional performance. So if there is something, maybe there aren't any discrepancies in medications and there's not concern about diversion, but if the person is not documenting well or is appearing very tired at work or looks like they did prior to going to treatment, we would expect the worksite monitor to inform us of that. So that relationship is key in terms of protecting the public. Other things for individuals who have diverted or who are chemically dependent, we ask for random urine toxicology screens. That process is not as it was described in the newspaper. Participants in our program are assigned colors, and the colors represent a frequency of screens, and then they are also assigned panels of drug tests to be tested for based on their substances of abuse. Our participants call our tox line every Monday through Saturday, and some also call on Sundays, between 6 a.m. and 4 p.m. If their color is announced that day, they need to provide a specimen by 6 o'clock p.m. that day. The specimens are mailed to a toxicology lab, and the results are faxed to us. If participants don't provide their specimens, we contact them to find out why they didn't provide the specimens. If the specimen is dilute, we contact the individual to find out the circumstances. If there's a female, very lightweight, who runs marathons, we might expect that she would have more dilute specimens, but we try to work with them to educate them so that the specimens that they provide are valid for testing. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we respond to tests in a moment. But I think I I guess I just want to emphasize that the only time an individual would know days in advance if they were to provide a specimen is if we cleared them from screens. For example, if someone was going to their grandmother's 90th birthday party, we may clear them from screens and say, we want you to provide a screen on Monday when you return. So that would be the only incident that someone would know in advance that they were required to provide a screen. Other individualized requirements are really developed in concert with treatment providers. For example, for people with bipolar disorder, their psychiatrists often state that they don't want them to work double shifts or night shifts because that could disrupt their sleep-wake cycle, which could cause an exacerbation of symptoms. So we try to tie the individualized requirements with what the treatment providers in the community are recommending. With regard to screens, the article in the newspaper was correct in that we don't report every positive, or not every positive, every problem screen to the licensing boards. However, for people who are referred to us under a board disciplinary order, we refer every problem screen to the licensing board. So the board would know that, for example, that someone missed a screen, that they provided a lewd specimen, that they provided the specimen late. We even notify the boards if someone forgot to call the tox line by 4 o'clock and they decide to go and provide a screen just in case their color was called. We'll report that to the board. So we do report problem screens to the licensing boards. With people who are in our program voluntarily, we have more discretion in terms of reporting. And some of the things we look at is the time frame between the problem screens. For example, if someone missed a screen on June 15th and then didn't have another problem screen until December 31st, we would take that into consideration. However, if someone has back-to-back problem screens or problem screens within a short period of time, we can't say that they are maintaining sobriety. So at that point, we do refer them to their licensing boards and report them. And as long as people are compliant with monitoring, then unless, again, someone's referred to us under a disciplinary order, the board doesn't have access to their private data, their illness-related data. However, if people aren't compliant with monitoring, if, let's say, they decide that they're not going to go to treatment any longer, we decide on our end whether or not that warrants discharge from the program, but it definitely would warrant a report to the licensing boards. We try to work in concert with the licensing boards to make sure that we're reporting issues that they can address, but also the case I talked about earlier with a June 15th problem screen and a December 31st problem screen. And problem screens are not positive screens. They are usually dilute or not completed on the date of request. Those situations probably wouldn't be reported to the licensing board unless we have other information from their employers or from their treatment providers that express concerns about how they're managing their illnesses. Toxicology screens are just one piece that we use in terms of looking at individuals' management of their illnesses. We don't learn of relapses just from toxicology screens. Our participants call us and inform us of relapses. We sometimes get reports from their employers and from their treatment providers. So I want to, I guess, emphasize that toxicology screens are just one tool that we use in looking at the individual's management of their illness.
So, Ms. Spider, I just want to ask you, so what is, since this is often voluntary, in the case where it is voluntary, what is it that, what is the stick?
The stick is that if they don't comply with monitoring, we would report them and discharge them to their licensing board. And then the licensing board could take action against their license. And I think it's important to recognize, in terms of discipline, some of the things that we may report to the licensing board isn't enough for the boards to take discipline against that licensee. There may not be any issues related to their practice. And for the most part, people who contact our program say, my illness never affected my practice. Why do I have to be in this program? And I tell them, you know, exactly, that's why you're here. We don't want your illness to get to the point that it impacts your practice. Because usually, with substance use disorders in particular, they show up at the workplace at the last time. They'll show up at family, they'll show up in other ways, but usually in the workplace, it's the last place that it's seen. Our reporting to the licensing board is the stick. And, you know, I want to also mention I think right now 33% of the people in our program reported themselves to the program. So that's a pretty high number of individuals who are seeking monitoring voluntarily, sometimes with coercion, oftentimes with coercion. Their employee health program might say, you need to be monitored by HPSB if you're going to return to work. There are self-referrals. The third-party referrals were an excellent resource for healthcare employers who are concerned about employees with illnesses that could impact their practice.
Okay, thank you. We're getting kind of close to the end. Do you have any final words, Ms. Feider? And then I'm not seeing any questions, but maybe we'll have a few here.
I guess my final words is I don't have any recommendations for the committee at this time. Because HPSP serves all of the licensing boards, I think it's important for the licensing boards to work cooperatively to look at potential legislative changes. We're not anything that affects our program or affects the Board of Nursing would affect all of the licensing boards, so it's important to get a variety of stakeholder input.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on the, are you subject to data privacy? And if so, what becomes public? I'm a little worried about discouraging people to go into your program.
Right. The data in our program that we receive will remain confidential unless the licensee is non-compliant. At that point, the entire file that we've received and data we've received about them goes to the licensing board. And the licensing board, if they take disciplinary action, can take pieces of that information to put into their stipulation and consent order. Does that make
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, and ma'am, I was curious about a couple scenarios. If they're in your program voluntarily, isn't there some reach you have to, if someone is diverting narcotics and somehow they do that and report themselves voluntarily and they work in home health care or something like that, isn't there a measure in place that you already can keep them from working independently?
Right.
I mean, there's so many measures. I know that if they're in a hospital, they can be, you know, limited as to the access they have via computer to the drugs, but you can also limit them from working independently. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Or in those types of settings?
We do, in addition to asking individuals not to have access to controlled substances for 12 months, for nurses in particular, we ask that they not work in home health care, that they not work in a float pool, that they don't work as a traveling nurse, that they don't work in a hospice setting. So we try to look at the work settings, and we also want the work setting to be pre-approved by us, HPSP, and if the nurse disregards that, then we would report them to their licensing board. For pharmacists, we ask that they not be the pharmacist in charge, that they can't be a preceptor for students, and other conditions. So it really depends a lot on the profession and then also the work setting itself. So excellent question. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Feider. I just wondered, you know, I know that with any chemical dependency, relapse is a high risk. And do you have any information of comparison of the people who have gone through your program compared to, you know, a standard population in terms of success rates, or is that not a fair question?
Yeah, well, two pieces with that.
Right, Ms. Feider, need to go through the chair. Go ahead.
Our Our success rate depends a lot on the profession. I always mention physicians because they tend to complete at the highest rate, in part because they have the greatest access to resources. They have more money for treatment than nurses. They're also not as, and I want to say considered as disposable as some other professions, where a nurse or another practitioner might be fired immediately for a substance-related issue in the workplace, but physicians may not be because they're seen sometimes by some healthcare institutions as more valuable. In general, the completion rate for people who've engaged in monitoring is about 50%. For physicians, it's closer to 80%. For nurses, it's closer to 50%. One of the key pieces, people say, well, is your program effective if only 50% of people are completing the program? And my response is that, yes, it is, because the other 50% that aren't, we're reporting to the licensing boards. And the licensing boards are reviewing those cases to determine whether or not disciplinary action is warranted.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nelson.
I just have a couple of questions regarding, one, the completion is maybe not exactly the metric that I'm looking for. I'd like to know, of the voluntary participants in HPSP, how many of them are then cured of those addictions or are addiction-free? And specifically, talk about that revolving door concept. In other words, how many, I think that was one of the terms used in one of the news articles, but what's the percent of returns, or how many people who have come through HPSP show up again voluntarily? That's my first question. And then the second one was, I thought I understood, I want to understand this a little better, that HPSP asks the voluntary participants who have an addiction issue to voluntarily not work in areas where the addictive drugs are. And that just seems a little hard to understand, that someone who has an addiction issue at the same time has the ability to voluntarily not be in a workplace position with access to those addictive drugs. So those are my two questions.
To the latter Spider. Question, sorry, Representative Liebling, members of the committee, individuals do comply with the practice restrictions that we put in place. However, not all employers are able to accommodate those restrictions. So there are some nurses who are referred to our program or refer themselves to our program who are voluntary, but they can't return to their previous job because it cannot accommodate restrictions that we put in place. And it's not just the nurse that has to agree to those restrictions, it's the employer as well. In terms of your first question was the revolving door, and this it's a complicated question, because on one hand you could look at the people that we've discharged to the boards who are then referred back. But there are also people, like you mentioned, who've completed monitoring and then refer themselves back. And the average, I think the last time I looked, the average time frame between someone completing monitoring and referring themselves back was 6 years. We've had people sober as long as 16 years and then report themselves back to our program. And I don't see that as a failure. I see that as the individual identifying that their illness is active again, whether or not it's a substance disorder, psychiatric disorder, or something else, and needing further monitoring and support for that illness. The other complicated piece related to that is that boards utilize HPSP somewhat differently in that we may monitor some people regulated by some boards longer with, I guess, a greater period of noncompliance while communicating that noncompliance to the licensing board, whereas others, it may be a sooner discharge from the program. Regardless, the boards always do the same thing in terms of investigating our reports, because they're considered complaints, but overall, the return rate to the program is about, of current participants, about 25%, or of all participants, about 25% are have previously been in the program.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Vider. And I, we are over time, members, and I just want to say it's important to remember, too, that it's not a treatment program.
Right.
So when we're talking about success rates, this is not a treatment program type of success rate. So thank you very much to everyone. Thank you, members, for being here. Thank you for our testifiers. We are adjourned. Oh, yeah.